So I'm gonna try to keep moving at a reasonable pace. But please, as always, so my temptation is going to be to move a little faster. But then if anything seems unclear, please make sure to stop me. I don't mean to go that fast. I just mean to remove the long rambling bits like this, where I just talk about nothing for a little while. So the idea is to finish the neutrino story today, and then the next two lectures will be devoted to explaining everything about interactions, how to figure out what processes are or are not allowed in the standard model, what can and can't happen, and with what probability, and some of the important things in particular that do happen that are a little bit subtle, but important. Okay. So let's pick up where we left off last time. So we were saying there's three models we're trying to understand the relationship between. There's the standard model itself, which is the model where we use everything but this line, write down all the terms we can, but only keeping terms up to dimension 4. So let's call that, so the Lagrangian we built there is as terms of mass dimension less than or equal to 4. And then there's the standard model effective field theory, where we still don't include this line, but now we allow ourselves to add all the other terms, including dimension greater than 4. So we have the terms we used to have, but then the idea is that now we regard this as the low energy approximation to some fuller theory, where maybe that fuller theory has new fields whose masses lie up at some scale capital lambda, but which maybe is, let's say, high above the electroweak scale. But so far, we experimentally have only probed scales up to the electroweak scale. And so in effective field theory, and this is something I'll explain, I'll get a chance to explain a little bit more in the next two lectures, and then also more in the second half of the course. But in effective field theory, you know, if you have some mass states that are just up at some scale that you can't access yet, there's a way in which you can integrate those states out of your theory and end up with an effective theory that only works with the remaining fields that you can access. And that theory will then be a non-renormalizable Lagrangian and will involve, in addition to the renormalizable part, will involve terms of higher dimension 5 and 6, etc. And if the mass scale lambda at which the states that you integrated out, the fields that you integrated out are, if that scale lambda is much higher than the energy at which you're doing your experiments, then you expect this term to be, these terms to be all small perturbations to this guy, and then these guys to be even smaller perturbations, etc. So there's some natural ordering to the perturbation theory like this. And so without knowing what the high energy theory is, we can then say, oh, well, if the standard model is the low energy effective theory of something, who knows what, then in addition to these theories we already wrote down, there should be these other terms appearing. And so last time we wrote down, I'll get to that in a second. Finally, then we want to introduce the what I was calling the neutrino standard model last time, and so again the difference here is that here, so this is we said you know, the basic, the most unarguable difficulty with this theory is that when we take this theory and couple it to normal Einstein gravity, which appears to do a good job on the solar system, then there are three things it can't account for. We said neutrino masses, okay, and oscillations, which we will be able to explain when we talk about interactions next time. The phenomenon normally described as dark matter and observed astrophysically, and then also the observed matter-antimatter asymmetry of the universe. The fact that at early times, when the universe was much hotter, and when it was above, when the temperature was as high as a GeV, there were protons and antiprotons in thermal equilibrium with the thermal bath, and so there were a lot of protons and a lot of antiprotons, but apparently for every billion antiprotons, there were a billion and one protons, so that when the protons and antiprotons annihilated in pairs, for every billion of them that successfully annihilated, there was one proton left over who didn't have a buddy to annihilate with, and those are the protons that you and I and the rest of the universe today are made out of. Okay, but you would like to explain why is it? How is it that in the early universe it could have maintained, could have established and maintained this situation where there were a little bit more protons than antiprotons? And the standard model is not compatible with that. Okay, I'll have to explain more about that later. But then, so we said, so this is not right. So what is right? Well, this guy is definitely closer to the truth. This Lagrangian is almost certainly, in some sense, right. Which, in the sense that I mean, anything in physics is right. You know, this is right to some extent. It describes. It's clearly a very good approximation to a lot of the physics we see. This guy is clearly an even better approximation to a lot of the physics we see. And in particular, it does a beautiful job of explaining neutrino masses and oscillations so well that it's pretty clear that it's on the right track, but it does not, it's no help in explaining either of these two. So it's clearly not the full story, and that's also clear from the fact that it's this non-renormalizable theory that comes from integrating out something. We haven't said anything about it just leaves the question of what that ultimate new physics is that we integrated out to get this low energy theory. It leaves that question unanswered. And so then new SM is the simplest and most natural extension of the standard model that does reduce to this in the low energy as a low energy effective theory. We add now the three right-handed neutrinos, which seem to naturally complete the sort of obvious patterns in the pattern of particles in the standard model, where every particle has every left-handed particle has a right-handed partner, and a couple of other patterns that I'll mention in shortly, and you may have already observed yourself in the table. And it now explains more. It explains all three of these things. It inherits this guy's explanation of the neutrino masses and oscillations. But then, as we'll see, it also gives a perfectly still compatible explanation for what 2 and 3 are all about. And then finally, very importantly, once you add the right-handed neutrino, it reveals that the structure of the standard model, that in addition to sort of the obvious patterns in this table, that there's a sort of appears to be some sort of there appears to be a beautiful, deeper, more subtle structure at work, which is so nice it's hard to believe it's an accident. But it basically can't be an accident. But what exactly the right interpretation of that is? Remains to be, you know, what's the interpretation of that clue remains to be understood. But that whole story will be left for the second half of the course. I want to just say a little bit more to finish up the story about this guy, and then introduce you to this guy. where I will, there will be a few points here where I, what I'm really doing is sketching derivations of things that I then want to leave as exercises for the tutorial and homework. Okay, see, did I want to say anything else here? Nope. Okay, so, last time we spent most of our time talking about option two, the standard model effective field theory. So let's just quickly recap and then finish off that story. So just to rewrite here, so I can point at it. So we have our Lagrangian consisting of the standard model Lagrangian, the dimension less than or equal to 4 terms, and then the dimension 5 terms, and the dimension 6 terms, etc. And we said, okay, so we just continue to write down these terms. It's just a matter of continuing the game we played to write down all the terms here. We think about all possible dimension 5 terms we can write down here, and oh, it turns out nicely that there's exactly one term, the Weinberg term. Which again has this form that it looks like minus 1 over 2 lambda times psi c bar times some matrix yij times psi j plus Hermitian conjugate, where this psi is this neutral spinner field I introduced of dimension 5 halves. So psi, again, I remind you, is defined to be h twiddle dagger l left. And then we said, after spontaneous symmetry breaking, once we plug in the VEV for the Higgs field, and then we look, as we have been so far, at we isolate the quadratic terms in the Lagrangian, then this becomes can be rewritten as minus 1 half nu bar m nu, where this nu is this Majorana fermion, which we built by adding the left-handed neutrino, which is a two-component spinner that sits down here, to its charge conjugate, which is a two-component spinner which sits here. So this, if we now take the charge conjugate, if we now take nu sub c of this whole thing, we end up just, this exactly gets converted to this, and this exactly gets converted to this. So this object is invariant. That's what we mean by a Majorana spinner. And we said that this term, okay, still looking at the dimension 5 terms, the key things to take away are that there's this unique Weinberg term which gives a Majorana mass to the neutrino. So the neutrino is a Majorana particle. It's its own antiparticle if this extension of the standard model is correct. This term we said it breaks lepton number symmetry. Again, we said that if we just looked at this first term, the standard model itself, we find that it has two accidental symmetries, baryon number and lepton number, two U1 global symmetries, not gauge symmetries, just global symmetries with no gauge boson associated. Just a fact that if we rotate the phase of certain fields in certain ways, the Lagrangian stays invariant. And so in particular, yeah, so on the one hand, if we rotate all of the quark fields by the same phase and let everybody else alone, that's baryon number invariance. If we rotate all of the lepton fields by a certain common phase and leave all of the baryons alone, that's another invariance. And in fact, the lepton number symmetry, in fact, in the standard model, actually it's three different symmetries. We can separately rotate the first generation leptons by a common phase and leave the other two generations and everybody else alone. And that's also a symmetry. So there's actually, really there's three different lepton number symmetries here, one for each generation. But anyway, the bottom line is that they're all broken at once by the addition of this extra term. And why is that? Well, if you look at this term, you know, we're used to we're used to things working because, for example, consider this term here, Q left bar times, you know, times the Higgs times U right. Well, if we rotate Q left and U right by the same phase, then this guy picks up that phase. This guy, we've taken the dagger, so it picks up the opposite phase, so they cancel. Whereas in this term, that doesn't work because, okay, let's look over here. So here, by this expression, we have a copy of L left appearing, but here we take the dagger, which complex conjugates, but then we take the charge conjugate, which complex conjugates again. So when this guy picks up a phase, instead of picking up the opposite phase, since we've charge conjugated, we've taken the complex conjugate of the field twice to write down psi c bar, it picks up the same phase, and so this term is not invariant. So that's why lepton number is broken, and you can also see that baryon number is not broken by this term because there's simply no baryonic fields, there's no quark fields appearing here. So any symmetry that only rotates the quark fields clearly will be unharmed by this term. Okay, so at this level, we've broken lepton number, but not baryon number. And in fact, this leads, well, okay, and then we said, on the other hand, if we keep going and write down dimension six terms, we'll find that the dimension six terms do break baryon number. Okay, and this breaking of lepton number and baryon number have experimental consequences that people are actively searching for. They've been searching for them for a long time and have not yet found them. There are some arguments suggesting that they have a good chance of finding them within the range that current or near future experiments will reach, but never put too much faith in those arguments because people like to never put too much faith in any argument like that. But nevertheless, I mean, it's certainly very. I regard these as both very well motivated experiments. So let me just describe them to you. So here, people look for neutrinoless double beta decay. So what's that? Beta decay is, you know, this name, beta is an archaic term for an electron or a positron. Okay, so in the early days when people discovered radiation, at the beginning of the late 1800s and early 1900s, they found that nuclei would occasionally emit an energetic particle and transmute into one or more lighter nuclei, and if they emitted a basically what we would now call a helium nucleus, they called that alpha radiation. If they emitted an electron or a positron, they called that beta radiation, and if they emitted a photon, they called that gamma radiation. Okay, so here what we're talking about is a process where the following happens. So basically, this is saying that you get a nucleus emits radiation, but what comes out are two electrons and no neutrinos. Okay, so just to explain what's going on, imagine you have a nucleus and it has some neutrons and it has some protons in it, and in general this is some heavy nucleus, so there's more neutrons than protons. Okay, so then one of the neutrons, a normal process in the standard model, if you have a neutron, is that it can decay into a proton, an electron, and an electron antineutrino. You know, note that this conserves the things that it should. This conserves electric charge because this has zero charge, and these two guys add up to zero charge also, electric charge, and this guy has no charge. It conserves baryon number since this is three quarks going to three more quarks here. So baryon number goes to baryon number one. The rest of these things don't have baryon number. It conserves lepton number, because we have lepton number zero over here. There's no leptons over here. Over here, we have a lepton E, and then we have corresponding anti-lepton nu bar. Okay, so far so good, everything's normal. But what can happen now is that, well, oh, secretly this guy has a Majorana mass, and so it can transmute into its antiparticle. So this thing can become an electron neutrino. But then, now there's another process where a neutron, where that electron neutrino can hit another neutron in the nucleus and do another standard model process, which is neutron plus electron neutrino goes to proton plus electron. Okay, so the same guy that gets emitted here can switch to its antiparticle and then hit another neutron, causing it to turn into another proton. So at the end of the day here, if you count things up, we've gotten two neutrons converting to two protons and two electrons, but no neutrinos. Okay, so people are looking hard for that process, which would be, you know, forbidden if this term was absent, but is predicted as the sort of leading lepton violating process if this term is present. Low energies, okay? Okay, and then similarly here, what people look for is baryon number violation. And as I said, one of the, you know, the most salient thing for you and me is that baryon number conservation is ultimately the thing that prevents protons from decaying. So people look for them to decay. They get a huge vat of protons, and they look for proton going to positron plus neutral pion, which then can decay to two photons. So anyway, basically protons converting to decaying to positrons, which again would be a forbidden process in the standard model, and would be a forbidden process even up to here, but is allowed once you include the dimension six terms here. Okay, but neither of those have been seen yet. Oops. Let's see. So and then we said maybe the one final thing to say here is that two things I wanted to say. So just to review, we said that L and B are accidental symmetries. So that's just symmetries that the fundamental symmetries of the theory are whatever you assume them to be. And then you write down the renormalizable Lagrangian, and you find, oh wait, since there's only a finite number of terms, it happens to have other symmetries which I didn't assume a priori. Those are accidental symmetries, and in general, they will be violated once you start including quantum effects and higher order terms in the effective field theory, and that's what happens with these guys. And finally, you know, just to be clear, the reason there's no dark matter candidate here. Why is that? Well, there's no new degree of freedom appearing. So the normal degrees of freedom in the standard model can't be the dark matter. There's no available candidate that's stable, but we haven't detected it yet. There's no new degrees of freedom here. Well, I'll say more about this later in the lecture, and then there's no explanation of the matter antimatter. Let's call that something somehow for short, matter antimatter asymmetry. You know, once upon a time, the standard model could have explained this. It could have done so, it turns out, in two different ways. One is that, okay, it turns out that you need, this is something for a different time that would not to be explained now, but there's these famous Sakharov conditions that you need to satisfy in order to get matter-antimatter asymmetry in the early universe, and so you need something that violates baryon number, and C and CP symmetry and thermal equilibrium. Okay, and we tried to remove as much freedom as we could from the CKM matrix by redefining the fields back in those earlier lectures, and we found we couldn't turn the CKM matrix into a completely real matrix. It had a complex phase left over. Okay, it had three real numbers and a complex phase that we couldn't get rid of. They were genuinely physical. Because of that complex phase, the standard model does violate CP, and it also violates C. But because that complex phase turns out to be is measured to be small, it doesn't violate CP much. Okay, it doesn't violate it enough. Also, in the standard model by itself, there doesn't seem to be enough of a violation of thermal equilibrium at the appropriate time in the early universe. So. And so as the universe cools down at very high temperatures, it turns out that the electroweak symmetry will be restored. So the Higgs-Vev, instead of lying at the bottom of its potential, will be pinned at the center of its potential. And so electroweak symmetry will be restored in the early universe. And then as the universe cools down, the field will make it one way or another down to the VEV, where it is today, but there's various ways it could make it there. There could be no phase transition, or there could be a second order phase transition, or there could be a first order phase transition. And if that first order phase transition had been strong enough, you would get a beautiful very strong violation of thermal equilibrium. And that would have been a nice place for the standard model to make the matter-antimatter asymmetry. But we now know, because now that we know the parameters of the relevant particles in the standard model, and in particular the mass of the Higgs and its self-coupling, we now know that it was not first order at all, let alone strongly first order. And in fact, it most likely was not a phase transition at all, but a smooth crossover. So there's not the required violation of thermal equilibrium in the early universe either, using just the standard model or the standard model effective field theory. Okay, so that's all I was going to say about that. Let's move on to the neutrino standard model. Am I going too fast? Lost anybody? Any questions? Should I pause? Okay, so neutrino standard model. So in fact, maybe I'll go over here. Okay, so now, what's the story with the neutrino standard model? Well, we want to add to the ordinary standard model the right-handed neutrino, and look what new terms get added to the model when we include the right-handed neutrino field. So now we're going to write down the most general Lagrangian built from all of the rows in that table, but we're going to write down the most general renormalizable Lagrangian. Again, we're back to only looking at the dimension 4 or lower terms. So what do we get? Well, the bosonic terms are the same. So the first two lines that we usually write down are the same. So I won't write those here. And then, okay, so now let's remember that we had the third and fourth lines were the kinetic and Yukawa terms for the fermions. So let's just get those back up here so we can look at them. It'll be a little bit easier notationally here to go back to the notation where instead of splitting everything up into, I did this whole process where I started with capital Y Yukawa matrices, and then I diagonalized them and absorbed using a singular value decomposition and absorbed unitaries and ended up with CKM matrix. That's all fine, but that level of detail won't be needed here, so I'm just gonna write them as capital Ys, which may or may not have already had that redefinition process done to them. Okay, but so sorry. Let me put the keep them in the same order as before. So we had one where the left-handed neutrino, or the left-handed quark doublet coupled to the right-handed down quark. And then there was another one where the left-handed quark doublet coupled to the right-handed up quark. And then there was the lepton analog of this term, where the left-handed lepton doublet coupled to the right-handed electron. Okay, and so now the first thing is that when we add the right-handed neutrino, we can add the lepton analog of this term. Okay, so we can write y sub nu times h twiddle, just like here, times the right-handed neutrino, and then plus Hermitian conjugate. Okay, and again, you can check that these are all of the Yukawa terms, all of the Yukawa couplings to the Higgs that you can write down. Again, if you're just trying to write down any non-zero term you can that's Lorentz invariant and gauge invariant, this is the only new term you can write down, and it's Hermitian conjugate. Okay, and now I forgot to write down the I put that I because I was originally meaning to write down the kinetic terms, but I didn't. Okay, so let's write the kinetic terms here. So, and let's focus on the quadratic part, which reminds me, I forgot to say one thing I wanted to say earlier. Sorry, let me just say one more thing here, which I forgot to mention, which is something I wanted to clear up after the last lecture, and forgot to do so, and almost forgot to do again. Okay, so this business where we the right-handed the mass term for the right-handed neutrino, we found it physically apt to rewrite that in terms of the Majorana neutrino field nu. So we should also rewrite the kinetic term in terms of the Majorana neutrino field nu. So what does that look like? Well, remember that when we were looking at the kinetic terms here, well, here I'll to explain it, I'll start by writing down the kinetic terms here. So since we'll need to do that anyway. So to continue here, if we look at the quadratic parts of the kinetic term, remember that we had I take it back. I won't do that. Sorry about that. So remember that when we looked at the quadratic part of the standard model Lagrangian, after spontaneous symmetry breaking, all of the other fields except for the neutrino paired up into Dirac fermions with Dirac masses, and so their kinetic terms. So for example, the down left and down right got paired into a Dirac fermion D, and the up left and upright got paired into a Dirac fermion U, and the E right and E left got paired into a Dirac fermion E. But there was nobody yet to pair with the left-handed neutrino. And so when we wrote down the kinetic terms for these guys and focused on the quadratic part, we found that they were like this. There was a d bar times d partial slash d, and then a corresponding term for u, and a corresponding term for e. But then the left-handed neutrino was still had its old form. So these are the ordinary Dirac kinetic terms for a Dirac fermion, but then the left-handed neutrino was still just involved the left-handed, the Weyl fermion nu left, so it was a Weyl kinetic term. So now, if we want to rewrite this thing in terms of the physical Majorana neutrino field nu, well, what do we do? Well, a little exercise shows that actually nu left C bar partial slash new left C, the corresponding term, in other words, the corresponding term with C's on it, actually after integration by parts, this term is the same as this term. If you just rewrite these guys using the expression new left C is equal to I gamma 2 new left star, you just plug this expression in here and then integrate by parts, you'll see that actually this expression is this expression. So we can write this expression as half of this expression plus half of this expression. And then we see, oh, that's nothing but 1/2 of our Majorana field nu bar, partial slash nu bar, okay? So in the standard model effective field theory, this is what the neutrino part of the Lagrangian becomes. The kinetic term is the standard kinetic term for a Majorana neutrino, and the corresponding mass term is the standard mass term for a Majorana neutrino. Okay, so I just wanted to say that as a warm-up for what we'll do over here. So over here, getting back to finishing the kinetic terms here, we have the kinetic terms we had before. Okay, and now we just can write one more here. Okay, and so you might, at first glance, if you did this exercise, you might think that those are the only terms that get added to the standard model. But an important thing is that there's one more term we can write down, which is an explicit Majorana mass term for the right-handed neutrino. Okay, so we can write down a term of the form or, in other words, if we took this thing and did the same trick, this is very similar to what we said yesterday when we were writing down the Weinberg term. When we were writing down the Weinberg term, we first built that neutral field psi, which didn't transform at all. It was a spinner field, but it didn't transform at all under gauge symmetry. And then we realized, oh, well, if we tried to write down psi bar psi, since it's a two-component field, that would vanish. But if we tried to write down psi bar c times psi, that would be a non-vanishing thing, but it would still be gauge invariant because each of the two fermions separately was gauge invariant. Well, the same argument applies here. If we tried to write down anything like nu right times nu right bar, that would be zero because of the spin indices would contract up to give zero. But we can get a non-zero thing by writing nu right times nu right C bar, because that's contracting again a right-handed field with the bar of a left-handed field, because taking C converts this right-handed field into a left-handed field. But now this is just like the field psi. Nu is, you know, if we look at nu right in the table here, it has a 1 in the first column, so it doesn't transform under SU3, it doesn't transform under SU2, and then it has zero charge under U1. So it doesn't transform under U1 either. So it's completely inert. It doesn't transform at all under the gauge symmetries. And so we can write down this extra term. And then, just like last time, we could define a Majorana field, nu prime, by adding nu right to its charge conjugate. So in other words, in four-component notation, this guy would have nu right for its top two components and nu right C for its bottom two components. And then this whole thing would become, you know, this term is minus 1/2 nu prime bar times this matrix M times nu prime. Okay, so this is some kind of Majorana mass term for the right-handed, for this field nu prime. Okay, now there's two things that we want to see. We want to analyze the whole theory and see what its basic particle states are, how they differ from the standard model. But before we do that, let's see that, as claimed above, it has the important feature that when we integrate out the right-handed neutrino, we get back the standard model effective field theory. Okay, so how do we see that? Well, we will discuss integrating out more properly in as one of the things in the next part of the course, but I just want to give a rough explanation of what happens here. So suppose that the right-handed neutrino is up at some scale, has some mass that's, let's say, well above the scales that we've been accessing in particle physics experiments. So we simply don't have, you know, when we collide two protons together, they have a total energy which is just below the rest mass of this field, and it's just not able to produce this field directly. Well, okay, so if we did produce this field, its energy, at least non-relativistically, would be its rest mass and then plus some kinetic energy. And so the least energy it can have is when it has no kinetic energy and its energy is just equal to its mass. And so, okay, we can't produce it directly. We can't produce it classically, but still quantum mechanically, we can still have it appearing as a quantum fluctuation, but it's going to be dominated by configurations where the quantum, because it's at some unaccessible energy, it's going to be dominated by quantum fluctuations where the energy is as low as possible, where we have the mass plus basically zero kinetic energy. So that's saying that we can basically ignore its kinetic energy in the Lagrangian. Okay, at those high scales. So let's do that. Let's imagine that this term is not present because this thing is at an inaccessible energy scale to us. We simply don't have the energy available to introduce any space-time fluctuations in the field. Well, once we ignore this term, then nu right still appears in two places. It appears in this term, and it appears in this term. But note that in both of those terms, it doesn't have any derivatives. It just appears, as the field itself without derivatives. Okay, but when a field appears without time derivatives, then it's like a Lagrange multiplier, and its equation of motion can be solved and used to eliminate that field from the Lagrangian. So let me say a word about that. So recall for a second that if you have a Lagrangian involving, let's say, imagine you just had a Lagrangian involving, you know, 2 degrees of freedom, Q1 and its time derivative, and Q2 and its time derivative. Okay, so the Lagrangian was a function of these two variables, Q1 and Q2. And so, okay, to get the equation of motion for Q1, you derive the Euler-Lagrange equations for Q1. Okay, so maybe I should have written, let's write this, let's say the action. So the Euler-Lagrange equations for, I vary the action with respect to q1, set that equal to 0. That's the classical equation of motion for q1. I vary the equation of motion with respect to q2. That's the classical Euler-Lagrange equation for q2. Now you might ask, oh, maybe if I'm only interested in q2, maybe I can do the following. Maybe I can get the equation of motion for q1, solve it for q1, and plug the solution in here to just eliminate q1 and just get an action for q2. Is that a correct action for q2? If I just looked at that action and vary it, will I get the correct equations of motion for q2? The answer in general is no. That's a no-no. You're not allowed to do that. But if this action only depends on q1, not on its time derivative, now when I vary the action with respect to q1, the Euler-Lagrange equation is what is called a constraint equation. It's not really a dynamical equation. It's not really a dynamical equation. And now I can solve this equation and plug the solution in to eliminate q1 from this action and just get an action for just involving q2. Okay, but that's the situation we're in over here. If we ignore this term for on the physical grounds I kind of loosely motivated before, then we have a Lagrangian that where new right still appears, but without any time derivatives acting on it. So what I want to do is derive the vary this action with respect to new right to get the equation of motion, the Euler-Lagrange equation for new right, solve that for new right, plug the solution back into this Lagrangian to eliminate new right, and see that it gives me back the same terms, including the Weinberg term that we had before in the standard model effective field theory at low energies. Okay, so let me sketch how that's done, and then that'll be done in more detail in some combination of the tutorial or the problem set. Okay, so if we ignore the kinetic term for new right and we vary the action with respect to new right, then the Euler-Lagrange equation we get is minus L left bar times Y nu times H twiddle minus nu right C bar times M sub M. You know what? Let me, to keep a couple of things separate, let me use the notation. I didn't write it here by accident, but let me call this guy M sub little m for the Majorana mass matrix. Okay, and I'll call this guy M sub little m. That's the same matrix there. Okay, so that's the equation of motion for new right. Now, so you can solve this. This is really just a matrix equation. Okay, so the way I would solve this, I'm not going to do it here, but you know, you can bring this term over to the right hand side, so it gets a plus in front of it. Then you can operate on both sides of the equation from the right by the 3x3 matrix, you know, so multiply, you know, hit it from the right by the inverse of the matrix M sub M. So that will eliminate this M sub M, and it'll introduce a factor of M sub M inverse here. Okay, so at the end of the day, I'll get some solution for new right C. Maybe I'll just write it here. So the solution for new right C bar will then be minus L left bar times Y nu times H twiddle times M sub little m inverse. Okay, and then I'm not going to write it here, but you can by just applying. Let's see, one useful rule, which I don't think I mentioned last time, was that if I have a fermion, I said you define the charge conjugate psi c of the fermion psi by I gamma 2 psi psi star, but then the same operation takes you back. So psi, if we now do this, if we take the C of this again, so we take psi C C by taking I gamma 2 psi C I gamma 2 times psi C star, that is equal to psi. Okay, so in other words, if I just conjugate this thing and hit it with I gamma 2 again, I get back to psi. So I can convert this, I won't do it on the board, but I can convert this to an expression for nu right or nu right bar or whatever I want. Plug that into that expression, and then one exercise it will be to check that that's the equation of motion you get. But then the other exercise will be that when you plug that into the Lagrangian for the standard model for the new SM, what new Lagrangian will you get? Well, we don't really care to write down the full Lagrangian you get. Again, let's just focus on the, where did I put this? I don't want to mess up the, this is a great place to introduce errors. Okay, so we plug this thing back in to that guy. So one way to write what we get is that if we then focus on the terms that are again quadratic in the fields after plugging that back in, we get minus 1/2 nu left bar C I times another matrix MIJ. So notice that this is not the same as this matrix here. That's why I added the subscript M there. This is a different guy. Nu left J plus Hermitian conjugate, where this mass matrix is given by minus M nu, which I'll define in a minute, times the inverse of this matrix MN times M nu transpose, where M nu is just the mass matrix, is kind of the mass matrix coming from plugging the VEV of H into the other Yukawa term up there involving nu right. So in other words, where M nu, this 3x3 matrix, is defined to be V over root 2, the Higgs VEV over root 2, times the 3x3 matrix Y nu, appearing in that other term involving nu right. But then, this is exactly what the Weinberg term became after spontaneous symmetry breaking and focusing on the quadratic part. So let's see, where does it go? And so again, if we rewrite nu left, if we combine nu left and nu left C into that Majorana field nu that I've written at the right of the top board, then that term will become the same as the Majorana mass term that we got from the Weinberg term. So it's the same thing. Okay, that's how you see that it reduces to the standard model effective field theory. And then okay, so then the final thing I want to do in the last 5 minutes here is explain what the mass spectrum looks like for the full theory, not just integrating out the right-handed neutrinos, but if we keep them and work out what their masses look like. Okay, because that introduces the famous so-called seesaw mechanism for producing, in fact, that's already the seesaw mechanism. I'll get back to the seesaw mechanism in a second. Forget what I just said. So now let's go back to this Lagrangian. We haven't integrated it out. Instead, that exercise was to show that when we integrated out new right, we got back to the standard model effective field theory. But now let's undo that. Let's look at the full theory, including the new fields new right. This is a theory that has more particles in it than the standard model effective field theory. What are the mass eigenstates now? What are the particles present? Well, everything except the neutrinos is the same as it always was, so we'll forget about that. Let's just focus on what happens to the quadratic part of the Lagrangian involving the neutrinos, okay? So we've already defined, now an exercise, which I won't do on the board, but it's going to be a simple exercise. Well, I mean, I don't want to say it's simple. It can be quite a confusing thing, actually, which is why it's important to do the exercise. But it's a straightforward thing that will be derived either in the tutorial or on the problem set. I'm not sure. I'll have to talk to Gong about which. But is the following: that so if as before, we're going to define the Majorana new field new by putting together new left with its charge conjugate. And we're going to define the Majorana field nu prime by putting nu right together with its charge conjugate. Okay, so now this is a column of three Majorana fields, because this has its index I, which runs over three generations. So this is three Majorana fields. This is three more Majorana fields. Let's combine those into six Majorana fields. Okay, so I'll call that capital Nu. Capital Nu is a column of six Majorana fields. The three fields Nu on top and the three fields Nu prime on the bottom. And so to avoid confusion, I mean, it's a confusing topic, but and like in everywhere in the standard model, you know, there's indices running around everywhere, and people, whenever they show you a something written as a vector or a matrix, you have to ask, you know, which subset of all the available indices are they actually displaying for me? So here, this is a vector whose four components are it's the spinner index I'm displaying here, and the top two components are the left-handed part, and the bottom two components are the right-handed part. Here it's different. Here I'm showing the index I, if you want, but now where I've combined two of these fields. So this index runs from 1 to 6, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. But so this is top and bottom here has nothing to do with left-handed and right-handed. You know, if I showed you all of the six fields in this column is a Majorana neutrino, okay, a four-component neutrino satisfying this Majorana condition. Okay, so then if I make that definition, and I just look at the quadratic parts of all the quadratic terms in the standard model in the new SM involving neutrinos, then what I get are a kinetic term, which is just the normal kinetic term for a Majorana neutrino, but now with six of them. Okay, and a mass term, which is the normal mass term for a Majorana neutrino, but now there's six of them. So the mass matrix is a 6x6 matrix, and I'll write it in block diagonal form in 3x3 blocks. So there's zero in this upper block, and then m nu and m nu transpose, where m nu is that matrix I defined at the top of the right-hand side there. And then in the lower right block, this is the matrix M sub little m, that matrix. Okay, and so then, now let's, so all that remains, whenever you, when you know, the story is always the same in physics in general, but also in quantum field theory in particular, is that almost all problems, when you solve them, you have a Hamiltonian or a Lagrangian, which involves non-quadratic terms, and you can't solve it exactly. So you look at the quadratic terms first, leave the rest of the terms as later perturbations to be dealt with. And then you, when you focus on the quadratic terms, there's some kinetic term, and there's the non-kinetic term. And the matrix which appears here is a mass matrix, and we have to diagonalize that in order to get into the basis in which we have the actual physical states of the theory. So let's diagonalize this matrix. So we can write this matrix as, so we're going to rewrite this matrix. It's a symmetric matrix. So we can diagonalize any symmetric matrix. We'll write it as an orthogonal matrix transpose times a diagonal 6x6 mass matrix times O. So the diagonal matrix I'll call M hat. Okay, so we rewrite this as O transpose M hat O. And then let's absorb the O and the O transpose into here and here. So by defining O times capital nu to be a new field, a new column of 6 Majorana fields, which I'll call N hat. Okay, so then if we do that, this Lagrangian becomes 1 half I n hat bar partial n hat minus 1 half n hat bar times the diagonal matrix m hat times n hat, where n hat, so now this is a diagonal matrix, and so these 6 states are now the mass eigenstates here. These are the actual mass eigenstate neutrino fields. Let's call the upper 3 lowercase n. These are going to be the 3 with, well, we'll see that 3 of them have light eigenvalues and 3 of them have heavy eigenvalues. So I'll call the 3 guys on top, which have light eigenvalues, little n. These are the ones that you actually observe in experiments at low energies. And then the capital guys, the 3 massive guys, which we haven't yet directly observed, I'll call capital N. The mass matrix, well, let's look at the case. The seesaw case is again the case where, sorry, the case which one usually considers, which is the famous seesaw case. Is the case where this matrix is much bigger than these matrices. And in that case, this 6x6 matrix is almost diagonal already. I mean, these guys are so small, they're almost zero, and in which case we almost only have a block diagonal thing, and we just have to diagonalize this guy. We can block diagonalize this thing to first order in these guys, and it turns out that when we do that, the upper block here is given by that, and the lower block is given by that. 2 leading order in the ratio of this to this. There's a small parameter, which is the size of this matrix divided by the size of this matrix. And to leading order, the block diagonalized matrix looks like that. Now, this would be the general 6x6 expression. And so this is the mass matrix. This is, again, exactly the mass matrix for the light 3 neutrinos appearing in the Weinberg term. This is the mass matrix for the 3 heavy neutrinos. Now, in actual process, you, in the either tutorial or problem set, You won't work out this general 6x6 diagonalization, although you can if it's kind of fun to do if you're interested, but just the simpler 2x2 case, which gives the basic feeling. But this is called the seesaw mechanism because the bigger M is, the smaller the three light neutrino masses are, because you see here it's the matrix M sub M appearing, but here it's the inverse of M sub M appearing. So if this guy has very big eigenvalues, this matrix here has very tiny eigenvalues because they're the inverse of this guy's eigenvalues. So that's called the seesaw mechanism is that when you drive these masses up, you drive these masses down accordingly. And so it's supposed to be an explanation of the smallness of the observed neutrino masses due to the largeness of the masses of the other unobserved neutrinos. So the final thing to say, maybe I shouldn't say the final thing. I'll say the final thing during the first 2 minutes of the next lecture, but really that's essentially the end of the neutrino story as much as I can fit in the available time next time we do interactions. And I forgot. Now that's two lectures in a row I forgot to take a break in the middle. Now that is unforgivable to let me do that without stopping me. Okay, but next time you really have to stop me. Okay.